CTBK is more than just a full-service accounting firm. They are one team with an innovative approach to accounting and rise to each new challenge with collaborative problem-solving skills. CTBK goes above and beyond by lending helping hands in the Buffalo and Niagara community through volunteer work and donations, and is partnered up with Victory Sports for 2020 and 2021 to keep kids in the community active. The professionals at CTBK are determined to help individuals and businesses succeed. Whether a large corporation, a small business, or somewhere in between, call CTBK at 716-630-2400. Again, 716-630-2400, and see what CTBK's one-team approach can do for you.
Welcome to another edition of Tim Graham and Friends, brought to you by CTBK, CPAs and Business Consultants. We are joined by perhaps my favorite F of all the TGAFs, Nick Bakay, who's taking a break from taping season two of Bookie after a great first season, obviously picked up again. You knew that was going to happen. The show with Sebastian Maniscalco and Omar Dorsey. I loved it. We had Nick on right before it came out. And he's kind enough to come back to talk with us about O.J. Simpson and his complicated legacy. We're going to talk about the Stephon Diggs trade. We're going to talk about Norm MacDonald, maybe, and David Lee Roth. And you're thinking, Tim, how is this going to happen? Well, you just leave that up to me. Everyone out there, and I will guide, hopefully, Nick Bakay through this. Nick, thanks for doing this.
My pleasure, Tim. I love talking to you.
I've interviewed Nick before, and the most recent time I interviewed him for a story was on was about O.J. Simpson's legacy for the Athletic's NFL 100 project, in which we ranked the 100 greatest players in NFL history. O.J. Simpson came in at number 41. And for that story, because I have a journalistic relationship, had a journalistic relationship with O.J. Simpson, I wanted to actually talk to him about it and about his legacy, asking him questions such as, what do you think the first paragraph of your obituary is going to be? But I didn't want it to be just OJ talking about himself. I reached out to all kinds of people who have differing opinions about this complicated. You can't just let one man talk about the complicated legacy. OJ obviously leaves a lot of things out of his story. But I interviewed Nick Bakay for it. And that's why I want to have Nick Bakay back. His commentary is sophisticated. It's poignant. It's funny. And I would love it if you weren't so friggin' successful in Hollywood to read you as a Buffalo sports columnist on your Sabres, on your Bills, on the whole thing. For those who don't know, Nick is a native Buffalonian, went to Nichols, and has done a ton of things in Hollywood. Let me just fluff you a little bit here, Nick, just for those who may not know. Salem the Cat, King of Queens, Seinfeld, The Angry Beavers, a writer and or executive producer on shows like Young Sheldon and Mom, Two and a Half Men, the Paul Blart movies, and then, of course, his most iconic job in Hollywood, Stu Dunphy, the game show host on In Living Color. So, Nick, you're of Hollywood. You're of Buffalo. You were 14 years old, by my math, when O.J. Simpson rushed for 2,003 yards. Maybe we'll start there, because we can ping pong all over the place when it comes to OJ's legacy. Let's start with the beginning for you. Mm-hmm. A lot of people just know the second half of OJ, or the third or fourth, whatever, the final installment of OJ. You were there at the beginning. What was it like, the phenomenon of OJ Simpson, Buffalo Bills running back?
I love starting there, Tim, because that's the thing that, you know, people don't understand. If you weren't here in Buffalo when OJ was at his peak as a football player, you just don't get it, the conflict that we experience with this. And the fact is, I go back to the rock pile with OJ. I saw him running there on really terrible Bills teams. I went to a lot of games there, and I remember a moment, you know, where, you know, they were just bad teams. That's sort of Dennis Shaw era. And I remember a moment where the Bills were in one of those, you know, two win type seasons, and OJ hadn't quite, you know, Lou Saban hadn't been brought back to unlock him yet, right? He was free of John Roush using him as a decoy, which is the kind of thing that only happens in Buffalo sports. We land OJ, and the original coach says, here's what we're doing. We're not using him. Great. You know, that is
we're going to line you up at flanker.
Yeah, you're going to flank, and we're going to give the ball to somebody no one remembers, and it's going to, you know, just that. If you're a Buffalo sports fan, you can say, well, that sums up my entire life. We were free of that bullshit, but it still hadn't really gotten that much better. And I remember one play, you know, it was sort of an off tackle, and game sucked, but you could just, the whole stadium could see a moment where OJ was off tackle right, and you could see the play. You could see the play as it was drawn up, and it was going to happen. And there was a pulling guard. I think his name was Howard Cheek or Cheeks, you know, journeyman type. And he was pulling, and the one guy he needed just put a hat on was lined up right. All he had to do is put a hat on him, as I used to say in my playing days. You didn't need to do anything miraculous. Occupy him, right? And let OJ do the rest. And the whole stadium you could feel everyone hold their breath. OJ's coming around. If he just gets a hat on him, it's daylight. Here we go. Cheeks, of course, stumbles, you know, collapses before even touching the guy. OJ's tackled for a 2-yard loss, and there's that collective groan, and that's where we were. And then, you know, Saban comes back, puts this magnificent offensive line in front of OJ, the electric company, turns him loose, and, you know, makes no mystery about it. We got Joe Ferguson as a rookie. He will pass three times this season. The defense is, we're not going to try and fool you. We're just going to annihilate you and wear you down. And it was magnificent. Plus, you know, this is when, you know, in the 70s, you have to remember, if you were a part of Buffalo in that generation, this is sort of the slow dismantling of the city on a grander scale. The sort of watching, you know, the Bethlehem Steel go out of business, and also other large employers flee the city to right to work states, and sort of the death of union jobs in America, and a great, you know, blue collar city lose its identity and lose its raison d'etre and just become a drinking town. The job became drinking, right? That was what people did for a living. And, you know, but in all of this sadness, we had this one jewel, and it was OJ. We had the best football player on the planet Earth, and he was, you know, at the peak of his powers, and he was also a superstar. He was, you know, on Hertz commercials, he was in movies, he was handsome, he was beautiful. He, you know, for some reason, this magnificent thing landed in Buffalo, New York, and he was ours, and it was pre-free agency, and I think before some level, you know, we'll get to Diggs, but there was no prima donnaism back then. It was like, you're a Bill, whether you like it or not, and he made the most of it. And OJ was our calling card to the world. It was such a great thing, and we loved him. And he never, ever talked crap about the city in a way that was offensive. You know, whatever he was feeling or thinking, he handled it very well. And we loved him for it. He was, you know, you could go to Mulligan's on Hurdle and see him there with a bottle of champagne. It was pretty groovy. So that's the love. That's the love portion. That's the A side.
While he was playing, he hosted Saturday Night Live. He was in movies while he was a Buffalo Bill. He was calling events for ABC Sports while still a Buffalo Bill. And that's outrageous even to think today that a player, I mean, yes, you might have a guy, an athlete host Saturday Night Live here or there. But I use this in my story to help kind of capture the time. I was a child and I grew up in Cleveland, so I didn't quite get it. I could guess because of, you know, the fact of what I do for a living, and I kind of have an appreciation and I know the history. But People magazine in October 1975 called O.J. Simpson, quote, the first black athlete to become a bona fide, lovable media superstar. And you think about that for a second. You're like, no, wait a minute. Now, how can that be?
Yeah.
But it was. And you could even think of somebody like Muhammad Ali, obviously universally beloved now. But at the time, Muhammad Ali was polarizing because of his stance on the Vietnam War, his refusal for induction. You know, he was hated probably more than he was loved at the time. And of course, we look back on OJ the exact opposite way. At the time, he was, according to People magazine, which is about as pop culture of a chronicler as you can get, said that he was the first black athlete to be a bona fide superstar, media superstar. He was everywhere and everybody liked him. How did your feelings about him change after his career with the double murder trial? Let me ask you, where were you? Were you in Los Angeles at that time? Were you working out there yet?
Yes, I absolutely was. I was out here fully ensconced. And, you know, and the 405 was, you know, not only national news, but here it was on every channel because it was local news too. It was on our freeway, you know, so I couldn't believe it. You know, every part of it was, you know, I certainly went through some denial about it because I didn't want it to be true. Because, you know, this is, you know, I've learned this, you know, having been lucky enough to have the career I've had in the entertainment industry. One of the things I've learned is that the people who were important to you when you were 12 matter to you in a different way than the people who are magnificent and cool, but you know, they manifested during your adult years. You know, I worked a lot of sketch and talk in my early career. I remember when I was Dennis Miller's sidekick for our first show, it was a big deal. And we had Tom Hanks as our first guest, right? Who's bigger than that? And I sat in a makeup chair next to him for our first show. And that was, you know, you would think like, well, that's pretty big. And it was very cool and all that jazz. But the weird thing is, but when we'd have someone weird on and wonderful like Tom Jones, right? Or, hey, we did a show with James Brown, who is my ultimate, the most iconic person for me in any category. That's when I got a little wobbly, you know, not meeting the contemporaries, but meeting the people who were the idols of my true youth. And that's OJ, right? He, you know, and so, and then he's a local hero too. So, I had lots of problems processing it. Everybody from Buffalo did, if they were of my generation, for sure. You know, and there's that little voice in my head saying, you know, great. You know, this couldn't be Earl Campbell. No, it has to be our guy. Yeah, we can't just lose four consecutive Super Bowls. Now, the guy who, I mean, let's be honest, this is the best
for
Bill
for
ever.
The record, this happened right after the Bills' fourth, right? It was their fourth Super Bowl loss, then this happens.
Early 90s, you know, and this is like the grige, as they say in Yiddish. The knife goes in and then grige, they twist it, right? It's just fucking brutal. You know, it's like, wow, what, we really are strangely cursed. This is the best player in franchise history. That's a fact, you know, and here we go again. So, you know, and I had all sorts of problems with it. And I'm sure I told the story about when I ran into him at the golf course and on your show, but you know, I had long after all was said and done, as my, sort of Canadian Irish grandmother used to say about complicated situations, well, it's all over now and the child's name is Anthony. This was after, you know, all he was acquitted and everything, and I ran into him at a public
I don't think
golf
you've told
course.
This on the, you may have told this on the show, but I know you've told me, but I can't remember if you told it on the show or not. So let's make sure we do tell it.
I am not a golfer, but every once in a while I entertain the notion. So there's a public golf course on Pico. It's a street here and near my where I was living. And I went there just to hit balls at a driving range. And you can park close, and if you don't get a close spot, you're off in, you know, in Mongolia, right? And so I'm walking up with my bag, and I see this big SUV trolling for a close spot, and the windows are very shaded out. And the window goes down, and it's OJ. And he looks through the window right at me, and he says, "Hey, man, did you park near here?" And at this point, I'm really active on ESPN, among other things, but I'm doing a segment on ESPN at least every week, and a column on ESPN, whatever. I can't even remember what the friggin', it's so long ago, Tim, but I was very active. And it's OJ. And I have that moment where all of a sudden I'm not an adult anymore. I am that 12-year-old kid from Buffalo. And I said, "No, I didn't, but I'm from Buffalo." And before I came to think, I say, "And I saw every yard of 2003. You know, and for the uninitiated, OJ was the first guy to get 2,000 yards in a NFL season, 14-game season, mind you.
143.1 yards per game. Still the NFL record by a lot.
Nobody came close to this day. Those who have 2,000 yard seasons, it's not the same deal.
OJ, by the way, will tell you that that was his second best season, but
interesting.
He thought that 75 was a better season. He only rushed for 1,800 yards.
I was going to say, is it the 18?
But he had 2,243 yards from scrimmage, a career high, because he added a lot in the receiving game. 23 touchdowns.
Oh my God. Not bad. Not too shabby. So I say that to him. He lights up and he looks at me. And the first thing he says, just to, you know, totally get me in the tent, is, "Hey, Buffalo, talking proud." Which for anybody in Buffalo in the 70s was the local civic pride campaign of this woman strangely dancing around Buffalo, singing a strange song called "Buffalo's Got a Feeling, Talking Proud." During a time where Buffalo had very little to be proud of. Anyway, and I'm like, "Oh, now we're connecting," right? And I'm thinking, like, and he says, "Hey, do you come here? Do you play here?" And I realized in that moment, you know, I could play golf with OJ every weekend for the rest of my life. And I can get the skinny on Jim Braxton and Lou Saban. And this is fascinating. And the writer in me is also just fascinated. Look, you sat down with him too, Tim. The writer in you couldn't resist, right? And I'm all these thoughts are going through my head. And then the adult me tapped me on the shoulder and said, "This is probably not what you need to be doing, because you are at this point just sort of this resident wise guy, funny guy on ESPN. And I don't think that's going to play." And, you know, and I sort of went, "Nah, I don't really." I kind of broke it off and I ended the moment. And I came home and my wife, Robin, looked at me, and she, you know, knows me well. And she said, "Wow, what is going on with you? Tell her this whole story." And I'm, you know, I'm ashen. I'm very conflicted. And then she takes a beat after it's all over, and I'm expecting some sympathy. And what she says to me is, "Just tell me he's not fucking coming over for dinner." So no comfort, just, you know, and there it is, you know. And she was right. I was right for my pain, and she was right for her concern. And that's OJ in a nutshell. Right?
Yeah. That's the dichotomy, and it's what I led my column with today. It wasn't a personal observation, which I eventually got into in my column, but for me yesterday it was the Pro Football Hall of Fame sending out a statement and lowering its flag to half staff for OJ Simpson, and the Buffalo Bills' silence. The whole reason that OJ Simpson is in the Pro Football Hall of Fame is what he did in Orchard Park at Rich Stadium, now Highmark Stadium. And the Bills, we don't even know who the fuck this guy is.
Wow. Makes me immediately think, Tim, when the new stadium is finished, will that name travel?
It won't. And it's more coincidence, although I think it's a bonus. The Wall of Fame is not making the trip into the new Highmark Stadium. It is going to be some sort of Legends Plaza type thing. They'll move the statue probably of Ralph Wilson over there. There are going to be these big Buffalo statues that are kind of showpiece for the outside of the stadium, a gathering place. And so the Wall of Famers will be honored in some way there. And I believe the only names within the stadium will be the three numbers that have been retired, 12, 34, and 78. In those players' names, perhaps. I'm not exactly sure how they're going to present that, but but you'll no longer be able to look up in the stadium and see OJ Simpson or very Pat McGroeder and Phil Hansen for that matter. But
Roger that. Pat McGroeder.
Right. You know, I would like to see if you could do some sort of geo data and find out how many times of all the searches that have ever been done on Google from within Highmark Stadium. I'll bet you Pat McGroeder is up there because people have to be thinking, who is that?
What was he? Was he a free safety? Yeah.
What were your thoughts yesterday? I know that everybody's come to their peace with OJ Simpson, I think long ago, but when you heard that he had died, did that sit with you at all? Or did that,
I have to say the first thing I thought was, if there's a hell, you know, because as much as I loved him as a youth, I have no doubt about his guilt. And the fact of the matter is, if you spend a moment contemplating the pain of the victims and their families, it's a terrible, terrible thing. How that pain was compounded by his insane acquittal. And I understand that trial was, you know, complicated by a lot of things that I also understand, but boy, and you know, how about Ron Goldman? You know, talk about wandering into the abyss with a pair of sunglasses. What the hell, you know? It's crazy. So that was my first thought, which is incredible for somebody that I really, really loved and admired. But, you know, all those things coexist. That's the reality all over, you know. To love somebody and to have a hero is to sort of open the door to the possibility of moral twilight, because these are all flawed human beings. This one, quite.
The complicated dynamic of Nicole Brown Simpson's family, because they have children together who were pretty young at the time, and trying to raise these kids, although OJ has custody, the hell that these families were put through.
Yeah.
$33.5 million judgment, in which OJ was found liable for both murders. Saw a report that less than $200,000 of that was paid out, and now the families are going to go after OJ Simpson's estate. It's now up to, according to the report I saw, $100 million with interest over the years. Wow. So whatever can be liquidated from the OJ Simpson estate, maybe we'll learn more about OJ. I the cynic in me says that the answer went to the grave on Wednesday, and any kind of closure is now gone, almost certainly, as far as I'm concerned, as far as, you know, in my opinion. How in between, you know, it's got to be. It's interesting. I want to ask you from a comic standpoint. We just talked about how horrible this was. The comedic aspect of OJ Simpson, he was comedic content for 30 years, right? I mean, he is still, Kenan Thompson is doing OJ Simpson on occasion. You know, he'll pop up in a sketch and he's OJ Simpson. You see a commercial and there's any you know, anytime you want to throw away about one of the most villainous people on the planet, that everybody can get behind O.J. Simpson's the punchline. How did you handle that as a comic? Did you ever have instance, or did you try to stay away from it because of your personal feelings? Did you, or maybe there was even part of you that thought it's because mocking people and who have gotten away with something is kind of about all the remedy you have at some point in some sense of making sure that he knows that he's to be ridiculed.
I'm very much of the nothing sacred school. And especially after, you know, spending the last 35 plus years in comedy writing rooms, you get broken for, you know, proper society, the things, the jokes, the topics, the attacks, the angles that we all sort of toss off casually and hold with great guffaws are not gen. I've had that moment where I realized, oh, I've got to really put the filter back on when I'm not in that environment, but that's where I live. That being said, you know, I've never really had OJ was never really an outlet for me. It's funny. I can't remember if I ever did anything about OJ. But I've certainly done plenty of jokes about Hitler, right? So it's not like I'm tiptoeing about the awful things. And some of the jokes that make me laugh the hardest and I tell in private are mind-bogglingly inappropriate and awful. So, but no, it wasn't an area. Now, you know, if it had been, I think I was kind of, oh my goodness. You know, I'm sure I wrote some of those. I'm sure I wrote some OJ jokes when I was in Living Color, or when I was writing monologue jokes for Late Night at that point in time, but they're gone with the wind, you know.
Right.
I'm sure we did.
I tweeted yesterday something that I was sworn to secrecy, and then I received permission from those involved that I could share it yesterday, since they're both dead. Norm MacDonald was the most vicious comedian regarding O.J. Simpson.
He got fired for it, basically.
He got Saturday Night Live. Yeah, he got fired because Don Ohlmeyer, who, and I forgive me for not knowing his title, I don't know, president or CEO, whatever he was of NBC, was good friends with O.J. Simpson. And through Lorne Michaels and whomever else, tried to rein in Norm MacDonald's O.J. Simpson jokes as the Weekend Update anchor. And Norm wouldn't do it, to Norm's credit, and got fired. Now, it began, obviously. I mean, you go on YouTube, they were all over the place being posted on social media yesterday. Norm MacDonald, you know, 20 minutes of him doing however many jokes, because the jokes themselves are 20 seconds long, right? And it's 25 minutes of just one after the other after the other. So Norm MacDonald had reached out to O.J. Simpson in 2019. Norm MacDonald was going to play in the World Series of Poker, and reached out to O.J., wanted to go golfing with him. Let bygones be bygones, the message said. And they wanted to do something. He proposed something scripted at first, and then said, or we'll just play for laughs, no cameras, and, you know, let's just golf. How do you think that would have gone over in the comedy world, that Norm MacDonald had made friends with O.J. Simpson?
That's a good question. I think a lot of it would have had to do with timing. You know, I mean, certainly my generation, and I actually worked with Norm on a writing staff and knew him a little bit. And so I know that Norm was the most unconventional, unique. Norm did whatever. Look, he said, oh, you don't want me to do those jokes, I'll do them until you fire me. To my great ultimate detriment, I will keep plowing ahead. So, you know, he wouldn't have given a rat's ass. And I know that my generation wouldn't have either. In fact, we would have thought it was hilarious and kind of spectacular. And if you knew Norm, quintessentially a Norm move. Norm was admired on a level that was pretty pantheonic, and rightfully so within the community as well as be outside. But we, you know, he was the person that comedians and comedy writers considered the top shelf. You know, but it's an interesting phase right now. You know, there is a wokeness and a there's a young generation now that is just precious and snowflakey and terrified and don't want to offend. And I know a million comedians who, you know, their bread and butter used to be playing college campuses, and that's gone because the vetting to get cleared to play a campus now is like you can't really can't say anything that
Jeff
offends
Dunham can do
anyone.
colleges still.
Maybe, I guess so. I don't know.
Puppet,
He's
you got to
got
have
the, and
puppets or
I'm
something.
sure he's got to leave it. I know one puppet he can't get out of the trunk. At least one. So I'm not so sure, Tim, you know, and that's Jeff fucking Dunham.
Touche, touche.
You know, but I'm telling you, it's so I don't know. I mean, I don't think it's a sustainable reality because it's so anti-comedic that it's death. But you know, we'll see. You know, I got 2 boys. I got 12 and 16. They are open for business comedy wise. So I don't know that it's going to live, but I do know that let me tell you something. When I'm
They can
building
get
a
into
writing
journalism.
staff, huh?
They can get into journalism.
No, they can't. No, they are open for business on comedy ideas. They're not precious. So there's a young generation that's not like that. I'm living with it. But when I'm building a staff for a show, it's like, look, here's how this works. You gotta have somebody who knows how to do this. And I know there's always wunderkinds. There's always that. You know, there's always a 22-year-old who's just born to it and can do it. Two of them, you know, but running a successful TV show is a really, really complicated thing. And it takes a lot of years and a lot of experience and exposure to do it well. You're going to have a couple of crusty motherfuckers. And they better be really talented and all that, but they better have some fucking years on the job too. And there's so much to contend with. And you just cannot feed the conveyor belt of a show with an order of episodes in production and tiptoe about writing comedy. And I think that's one of the reasons why you see a lot of shows swing and a miss these days because they're about a careful agenda as opposed to the melee that you need to produce a good, funny show. But also, when I'm staffing, I'm very, very wary. If you're going to be in the room, check it at the door, pal, you know, because everybody's, you know, I don't care what you are, you know, look, I'm a big, fat, pink, old motherfucker. Make all the big, fat, pink, old motherfucker jokes you want. I'm not going to wet my pants. And let's go from there, you know.
How big do you think it would have been? And this is the part I guess I omitted I in my when I was talking about OJ and Norm possibly getting together, is that OJ was going to do Norm's podcast before Norm McDonald passed away.
Well, I would have paid money to
How
hear that,
right, how
right?
big could that have been?
I don't know about that. Big, I don't know. You know, honestly, I don't know
I
because
mean, I'm
most
not talking
big,
about theaters, but
no, but I don't know. I mean, the big podcasts evade me, Tim. So I am not, I can't tell, you know, because I actually like podcasts that are, it would have been big with me. But I think when I check out the podcasts, not all of them, but a lot of the ones that are really doing pretty well. I feel like they're not particularly entertaining. You know, I think they're underprepared and underproduced. And I think people rely on their they think that the two entities are enough
People are
as
watching one
opposed.
of those right now.
Oh no, they're not. Yeah.
Let's stay on comedy for a little bit. You've given me well, how about this? Anything left to say about OJ that maybe you didn't, that I didn't ask you about that's germane and you just want to mention?
No, I mean, I think we covered it just because, I mean, you know, look, I wanted to get in that, you know, the world reacts, but if you grew up with him during his prime in Buffalo, I love that we got to talk about that because that is the thing that does get buried because it's literally called the crime of the century. I guess the only other thought is like, you know, you want to talk about a life writ large. This is nuts, right? Heisman Trophy, 2,003 yards in a 14-game season, crime of the century. Jesus Christ.
Nordberg.
Right? Huh?
Nordberg in Naked Gun. Capricorn okay. 1.
Towering
Inferno.
It's crazy. It's
Battle
just
of the Network
crazy.
Stars, Nick.
Have you seen that hilarious? I guess it's a GIF or whatever the fuck, you know, but that thing where it's Howard Cosell with OJ and Bruce at the time, Jenner.
Yes.
And the caption is, "Ladies and gentlemen, I'm coming to you from the future, and you're not going to believe what I'm about to tell you." You know, that says it all.
I want to ask you, just because it's, you're a comedian who I respect and it's fresh. What did you think of Curb Your Enthusiasm finale?
I didn't see it. We are shooting season two of Bookie and I've honestly been on locations until like 3 a.m., 2 a.m. So
have you heard about it
much? I've only heard that it echoed the Seinfeld finale a little bit.
All right. Well, then I won't.
And I will say I did hear one person say they wish Richard Lewis hadn't been in it because he looked so
sad. Yeah, he looked rough. He looked rough.
And like we get it. And yet somebody said, I don't think that was a great move for the legacy. And I don't have an opinion either way because I didn't see it.
I would agree with that. Okay. In closing, this is something I've always wanted to ask you about and never really did because we have so much else to talk about. Your wife, Robin, who you mentioned earlier,
yeah,
used to represent David Lee Roth. She was his publicist, correct? Is that right?
No.
What was it?
No, close, ish. She wrote for him. We both wrote for him. And then it really became Robin's gig. At one point did a Vegas show and a buddy of mine got hired to write banter and patter for it. And he was really busy. He was working.
Well,
I think he's writing.
I apologize for insulting your wife by calling her a publicist.
Oh no, that's not an insult at all. But he, I think he was working on it. He got a job on the Tonight Show and he couldn't do it. So he suggested us. And so we got this phone call. I remember on our phone machine, that'll date it. There's carbon dating. And it was Dave. Hey, it's David Lee, blah, blah, blah. I'm doing Vegas show. Blah, blah. And I remember we still remember the message ends with, "Well, that's it. And I hope your life remains a cabaret." And we were laughing at that. And we thought, well, this is too good. And so we sat down with him and he was doing a Vegas show and he had these two super hot dancing girls with him and it was like Diamond Dave meets Vegas. And so we said, got it. And we just wrote a batch of material for him. And the next thing we know, he flew us out to Vegas. He was playing Bally's and we had got really nice seats down front in the big showroom and we got our pads out just to make notes on what he used. He used everything. And it was like, wow. And we went backstage and we talked about, and it was kind of like the kickstart of this long, fascinating relationship where, and as time went on, Robin really was the one who connected with him as a comedic voice, as almost a consigliere. And it took on a million different incarnations and moments. and it spanned many, many years all the way through the Van Halen reunion.
I think that's why, in my mind, I thought she was I thought she was the publicist, because in my mind, she was the gatekeeper. Like, if you wanted to get to David Lee Roth, did you have to go through Robin? Was that it?
She never had that relationship. There were others. There was always a gatekeeper, but that was not her place. But she did play a very essential role. If he was in any kind of situation or trying something new or under any, I mean, there were a million incarnations where he leaned on her to help form anything from talk show panel to, she wrote some lines for him on stage that were magnificent. It was really an all-purpose co-muse, fascinating relationship. And we connected with him in millions of places and millions of scenarios. One of the great ones, you mentioned that I was one of the voices on the Angry Beavers, an old Nickelodeon cartoon. We went to Vegas because Dave was the headliner at like one of the huge parties at the Hard Rock for like the porn convention. And we were there. We had his sound check and it was great. And we met a couple of people who were up for awards that night. And one of the guys mixing or something, he had my beaver character tattooed on his arm. And I went, oh, you know that I'm that's my guy. I'm Norbert. I'm there. And one of this couple who were up for awards said, oh my God, you're Norbert. That's great. And I looked at them and I said, how on earth would you know this cartoon? And of course the response was, well, our kids love it. And the next thing I know, they were up for, you know, best anal or something like that. So, you know, but I will tell you that we love Dave, loved working with him. He's smart. He's fascinating. And through that relationship, we had 1,000 adventures, just a great experience.
Is there anything that you could say regarding his on again, off again relationship with Van Halen?
I think, you know, it's funny, when we met him, it was very much off. And I remember there was a brief reunion for like, they won an award. It might've been the Hall of Fame, or it was an MTV thing, or there was a brief reunion, maybe an MTV award. And there was a little light of hope, and it didn't work out. And I remember him saying to us, oh, you know, I had just gotten to the point where if I was putting gas in my car, guys weren't coming up to me going, hey, man, you got it, fuck me. You know, it just gotten to the point where that shit had died down, and here we go again. You know, he always handled it pretty well. But listen, he's a complicated guy. You know, working with him, I'm back to the Diggs trade here. You know,
I was just going to use that as my segue.
There's that old expression, you know, about, you know, assholes are like splinters. They work their way out of your body eventually. You know, they work their way out.
After I got too hasty in asking about David Lee Roth, and I'm plotting how I'm going to, because I said at the beginning of the podcast, we're going to talk about Diggs. I forgot.
Yeah.
And now here you go.
With brilliance comes complicated people. And I've seen that side of Dave. And, you know, I can imagine over the course of many, many years, that's not an easy relationship to maintain. I don't know the Van Halen boys. They might be just as difficult. But I will say this. We were with him all the way through. And when they went back on tour and they finally did get back together, it was just great. And they sounded great. And they played well with each other. They, you know, however they worked it out, they worked it out. And we saw a ton of those shows. We went and saw him in Madison Square Garden. We saw him in L.A. at Staples, what it was Staples then, and we saw them all over that tour, and it was a beautiful thing. You know, hey, It's all over now, and the child's name is Anthony. So there you go.
Stephon Diggs trade. Then we'll wrap it up.
Yeah.
How did you digest that?
I looked at it completely through my show business lens and thought, yeah, that's it. That, you know, whatever happened, the final straw got snapped. And you know, we only know what's out there in the world. And they seem to be pretty good over at One Bills Drive about, you know, you listen, you walk the beat, you probably know much more than the average bear. But you know, I know they were very ham-fisted at the start of camp last year and things were really bizarre, but you know, it's the same thing with like the 13 seconds in Kansas City. You know, like they'll shit the bed, but then they kind of lock it down tight, right? So like, look, we know weird shit goes down, but then they lock it up.
It was Josh Allen from the start of his career. He'd play like a spaz for three quarters, and then in the fourth quarter, it was like, who's this guy? Like he would start comebacks galore.
Yeah, you know, and I just don't know what it was, but I think he finally wore it out. And, you know, it's look, he wore it out in Minnesota, too. That's why we got him. So I'm sure he'll be just dandy down in Houston for a year. If he still got it, you know, I mean, the way he faded, I will say my first thought at I watch a lot of those Bills games. I hold on to them on my DVR and the way he disappeared halfway through last season and the way the emphasis changed in the offense when Brady took over as coordinator, a part of me thought maybe we got ahead of the fade on this one. But I was shocked when I heard how much money they were eating. When I heard that, which was like that one landed a day later in terms of my awareness, I thought, oh boy, that's really interesting. They just had to punt him. So,
right.
And I'm worried, you know, I mean, I have a lot of faith in Bean. I think he knows what he's doing, but they sure have to do something. And I don't think that people who take solace in this Kansas City model of, hey, they won one with no good wide receiver. I don't want to go that road. Do you?
They would need a Travis Kelce. I don't know that Dalton Kincaid is that yet.
He's not that yet, but he's lovely. But yeah, no, I think we need something.
Yeah, there's a second round pick that they have at their disposal now, and it's a Vikings second round pick. Which is where it originated. So keep an eye on teams. The value is going to be commensurate, as I should say, with how the Vikings do this season. So teams might actually look at that as an early second round pick, depending on how you project. But
we don't know what their quarterback's going to be. So you're right, and I hope so because you know I do. You know, but I'm all I never liked the skull fucking of Josh. You know. I just didn't, you know, and I don't know I don't know these guys from Adam, but you know, look, I've had so much fun watching Josh Allen be the Bills quarterback, even with the brain fart moments of the water. I don't really care. It's just so wonderful because it's so exciting, and I'll take the bad moments all day long because they're worth it. Because when that guy lights up with his legs or his arm, when he lights it up, I'm like, this is, what more could you ask for? It's beautiful. And I love his energy. So we'll see.
Will there be any Bill's Easter eggs in the season two of Bookie?
I think we got one Bill's bet so far this year, but I tend to keep it. I play the field.
Right. Well, I can't thank you enough, Nick. And to take a break, I guess, where are you in the process with season two?
We right now we're week just wrapping up our second week of production. It's really going well. It's really been fun hitting week two of season two. Everybody came back in stride. I love our cast and we had so much fun writing this one. You know, it's that great privilege of knowing your actors, knowing your characters, knowing your world. It's vetted, it's kind of proven, And now we're off to the races, and it's been just great.
Is it more liberating, or is maybe that's, I don't want to put a word in your mouth, but when you're getting, when you've been renewed already, as opposed to trying to write a season, part of it is you obviously don't want to just write one, you're auditioning for the second, and granted you're auditioning now for the third, but is there a change in a demeanor of how you can maybe go about things when you've been renewed?
Generally speaking, it doesn't help, you know, to think that way. You know, the process, you know, and that I suppose is incumbent on how much you're getting noted, how much pressure you're getting from external forces about everything from the direction of the writing to the casting to all that stuff. But we have been very lucky in that regard. But whether you're writing a script in a void or you're actually in the machine like we are, the more you can eliminate the jury and the result and all of that, that is the best way to go at it. Because everything I did that I was calculated about, it just doesn't work out. You know, this whole project, I remember when this started to gestate, I was like, I've got to do it, but this one doesn't have a prayer. So, you know, it's speaking of bookies, trying to handicap these things is your first mistake. You just go where it's flowing and let the chips fall.
Nick, thank you for doing this. I'm grateful as always.
Likewise, Tim, I love talking to you, brother. Yeah.
Likewise.
And, I'm going to be back in Buffalo in September. And then I think there's going to be an announcement about why maybe later this week.
Well,
a teaser. That's what we call a tease.
Can it be later this week? It's already Friday.
Oh, I guess it's
See, you're
week.
In you're shooting, yeah. So everything's probably a blur for you.
It is a blur. I don't even know. We were in a trailer park till 4 a.m. last night. So you're right.
Is it sports related or is it
it's Buffalo related? It's sort of Buffalo entertainment related.
Dig that.
Yeah.
Dig that. All right. I'll keep an eye out for it.
I'm very excited. So maybe I'll see you at the Swanee, buddy.
I would enjoy that.
Yeah, likewise.
Immensely.
Yeah.
Nick Bakay, a.k.a. Stu Dunphy, and nothing else in my mind. Thank you for joining the show.
All right. Thanks, Tim.
The financial needs of a business go beyond tax and attest services. That's why CTBK goes beyond accounting services and offers outsourced solutions through their affiliation with CFO Solutions Plus. These additional services allow clients to focus on their operational and long-term strategic goals. Trust CTBK's outsourced solutions to provide cost-effective, value-added financial services tailored to your company's needs. Call CTBK at 716-630-2400. Again, 716-630-2400. Or go to ctbk.com to learn more about CTBK's outsourced solutions.